Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Ten Commandments in American law right after this. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with them, because they've been banned from our public schools, they're banned from our public institutions, and they've been banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they're teaching these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, in our public institutions, and we've made them a part of our national psyche. Now, you know, this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years, don't you think? Are you aware that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion arranged, that's right, an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments. They even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's at least one school left in America that still teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits for their observance. Now, you know, every law has a penalty. You don't have to know what the penalty to the law is to suffer from its effects. So whether we call this the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, the Common Law, Natural Law, or Karma, or something else, it's automatic. It works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happen to be the natural penalties for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. And you can call right now and order one. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click on the email. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? All right, this final chapter, final segment here, we're talking about the Ten Commandments in American law. There's a philosophy that is in back of all of this law, a philosophy that's different from Chinese and Japanese and African and South American Indian law. Those people recognize certain basic principles, but there's a philosophy that comes from the Ten Commandments that's unique, totally unique. It was John Adams, I think, that put the nail on the head, or the hammer on the nail, when he made an observation concerning this thing of the Ten Commandments. He said it was written for a moral people. On September 11, 1811, John Quincy Adams wrote a letter to his son from St. Petersburg in Russia while he was serving for the second time in the U.S. ministry to that country. And he said, "It is essential, my son, in order that you may go through life with comfort to yourself and usefulness to your fellow creatures, that you should form and adopt certain rules or principles for the government of your own conduct and temper, and it is in the Bible. You must learn them." Then Adams said, from the day of the Declaration, they, the American people, were bound by the laws of God which they all, and by the laws of the gospel which they nearly all acknowledged as the rules of their conduct. So John Quincy Adams recognized that the Bible was the foundation for morality. He had more to say about that when he made an observation that the Ten Commandments, the Bible, is written for a moral people, and that an immoral people, it would not work. Our Constitution would not work for an immoral people. It's a unique document. It's something that not everybody has, not everybody can use. Now, Sir Francis Bacon, he was born in 1561, he died in 1626. He was the Baron Verulam, the Viscount of St. Albans, and the Lord Keeper of the Great Seal under King James I. As Lord Chancellor of England, he was significantly responsible for the formulation and acceptance of the scientific method, which stressed gathering data from experimentation and induction rather than through the practice of philosophical deduction promulgated by Aristotle. Sir Francis Bacon was responsible for helping to found the Royal Society of London. Here's what he wrote. He said, "There never was found in any age of the world either philosophy or sect or religion or law or discipline which did so highly exalt the good of the community and increase private and particular good as the holy Christian faith. Hence, it clearly appears that it was one and the same God that gave the Christian law to men, who gave the laws of nature to the creatures." A fellow by the name of Hugo Grotius, President James Madison described Hugo Grotius as the father of the modern Code of Nations. Grotius, who was born in 1583 and died in 1645, was a Dutch jurist, theologian, and statesman who was considered the founder of the science of international law. In 1607, being 24 years old, he was appointed advocate general for the provinces of Holland and Zealand. In 1613, at the age of 30, he became the chief magistrate of Rotterdam. In 1619, Prince Maurice of Nassau sentenced him to life imprisonment for his support of the Armenian faith, and 3 years later, with his wife's help, he escaped to France, hidden in a linen chest. Hugo Grotius published De Jure Bel Epacis on the law of war and peace in 1625, which was a study of the laws of mankind in reference to individuals, nations, and states. From 1635 until his death, he served as the Swedish ambassador to France. Now, in his work on the law of war and peace, Hugo Grotius said this. He said, "Among all good men, one principle, at any rate, is established beyond controversy, and that if the authorities issue any order that is contrary to the law of nature or to the commandments of God, the order should not be carried out. For when the apostles said that obedience should be rendered to God rather than men, they appealed to an infallible rule of action, which is written in the hearts of all men." Now that's a direct citation from Acts 5, verse 29, where Peter is reported to have said that men should obey God rather than men. He said we should obey God rather than men. If there's a controversy between the laws of Texas and the law of God, the law of Texas fails. That concept, that principle comes from the Bible. That principle has been espoused by our founding fathers and by legal thinkers for thousands of years. It's a part and parcel of Anglo-Saxon administration. Indeed, it's a part and parcel of American law. And wherever you live in the world, it's a part and parcel with your law that you ought to obey God rather than men. John Locke, from 1632 to 1704, was an English philosopher, diplomat, and educator whose writings had a profound influence on America's founding fathers. He received his master's degree from the Christ Church College of Oxford University in 1658, and he lectured there on Greek philosophy and rhetoric. He served as a diplomat to Madrid in 1665. He moved to France in 1675, then to Holland in 1683, returned to England in 1688. Locke's works include A Letter Concerning Toleration, Two Treatises of Government, An Essay Concerning Human Understanding, Some Thoughts Concerning Education, The Reasonableness of Christianity, of nearly 15,000 items of the Founding Fathers, which were reviewed, including books, newspaper articles, pamphlets, monographs, etc. John Locke was the third most frequently quoted author, and in his Two Treatises of Government in 1690, he cited 80 references to the Bible in the first treatise and 22 references to the Bible in the second. John Locke elaborated on fundamental concepts such as parental authority, separation of powers, private property, the right to resist unlawful authority, unalienable rights, the government by consent, whereby governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, concerning the idea of a social compact, a constitution between the people and the government. And John Locke traced its origins to the paction which God made with Noah after the deluge. John Locke classified the basic natural rights of man as the right to life, liberty, and property. This not only influenced Thomas Jefferson, who penned the Declaration of Independence, but also elements in the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. In the Second Treatise on Civil Government in 1690, John Locke said, "Human laws are measures in respect of men whose actions they must direct, albeit such measures they are as have also their higher rules to be measured by, which rules are two, the law of God and the law of nature, so that laws human must be made according to the general laws of nature and without contradiction to any positive law of Scripture, otherwise they are ill made." John Locke. Today, laws that come out of our legislatures are made pursuant to commerce. These are commercial laws. Buckle your seat belt. That's a commercial law. Drive 55. That's a commercial law. These commercial laws have nothing to do with the health, the safety, or the welfare of the people. When we're talking about laws, rules, regulations, and government bailouts, we're not talking about the health, safety, and welfare of the people. We're talking about the health, safety, and welfare of the aristocracy, the banks, the government, of big business. And as a result of that, we suffer from it. The dereliction of duty that we see on the part of individuals, the inability to take responsibility for our own actions. That's why we buy insurance, and insurance companies prosper, because you and I are unwilling to shoulder the responsibility of strict liability. We want, rather, the comfort and security of limited liability. Let somebody else be responsible for my actions. Well, Sir William Blackstone, he lived from 1723 to 1780. He was an English jurist who deeply influenced the growth of the common law. He greatly influenced jurisprudence and the basis of law in America. In 1758, he was honored by being elected Oxford's first venerian lecturer, and in 1770, he became one of the judges of the Common Pleas. From 1765 to 1770, Sir William Blackstone published his highly influential work entitled Commentaries on the Laws of England. These were so universally accepted in America that by 1775 they sold more copies in America than in England. This work set the foundation for America's great legal minds, including Chief Justice John Marshall. Sir William Blackstone expressed the presuppositional base for law in his Commentaries on the Laws of England from 1765 to 1770. Here's some of what the greatest legal mind in England had to say. He said, law of nature, this will of his maker, this will of his maker is called the law of nature, for as God, when he created matter and endued it with a principle of mobility, established certain rules for the perpetual direction of that motion, so when he created man and endued him with free will to conduct himself in all parts of his life, he laid down certain immutable laws of human nature, whereby that free will is in some degree regulated and restrained, and gave him also the faculty of reason to discover the purpose of those laws. Now, considering the Creator only a being of infinite power, he was able unquestionably to have prescribed whatever laws he pleased to his creature, man, however unjust or severe. But as he is also a being of infinite wisdom, he has laid down only such laws as were founded in those relations of justice that existed in the nature of things antecedent to any positive precept. These are the eternal, immutable laws of good and evil to which the Creator himself and all of his dispensations conforms, and which he has enabled human reason to discover, so far as they are necessary for the conduct of human actions. Such, among others, are these principles: that we should live honestly, should hurt nobody, and should render to everyone his due, to which three general precepts Justinian has reduced the whole doctrine of law. This law of nature, being coeval with mankind and dictated by God himself, is of course superior in obligation to any other. It is binding over all of the world, in all countries, and at all times. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to the laws of God. Revealed law. This has given manifold occasion for the interposition of divine providence, which in compassion to the frailty, the imperfection, and the blindness of human reason, hath been pleased at sundry times and in diverse manners to discover and enforce its laws by an immediate and direct revelation. The doctrines thus delivered we call the revealed or divine law, and they are to be found only in the Holy Scriptures. These precepts, when revealed, are founded upon compassion to be really a part of the original law of nature, as they tend in all of their consequences to man's felicity. But were not from thence to conclude that the knowledge of these truths was attainable by reason in its present corrupted state, since we find that until they were revealed, they were hid from the wisdom of the ages. As when the moral precepts of this law were indeed of the same original with those of the law of nature, so their intrinsic obligation is of equal strength and perpetuity. Yet, undoubtedly, the revealed law is of infinitely more authenticity than that moral system which is framed by ethical writers and denominated the natural law, because one is the law of nature, expressly declared so to be by God himself. The other is only what, by the assistance of human reason, we imagine to be that law. If we could be as certain of the latter as we are of the former, both would have an equal authority, but until then, they can never be put in any competition together. And upon these two foundations, the law of nature and the law of revelation, depend all human laws. And that is to say, no human law should be suffered to contradict these. Now, he's the second writer. Locke was number one, and Blackstone is number two, who validate and ratify Acts 5, verse 29, which says we ought to obey God rather than man. It's a principle of law that is indelibly inscribed in Anglo-Saxon administration. That's why we Americans, for the rest of you people around the world, appear to be such a lawless and rebellious bunch. And that's because whenever we form a government, there will always be those elements of evil and wickedness that infiltrate those governmental positions and then impose upon us laws that contradict the law of God. In the past, we have rebelled against that and we have done that which God has instructed. It will be interesting to see whether we will do that again in the present crisis. If I were a betting man, I would say I would bet no. I don't think that we any longer in this nation have the moral character to choose the law of God over the laws of men. And furthermore, Bible prophecy tells us that we're going to line up to take our mark of the beast. Now, I've mentioned this before. I guess it's a good point to, or a good point of law or order right now to point it out again. We have now entered into a period of economic crisis that has now enveloped the entire world. And our politicians are telling us, just sit back and relax. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to solve this problem. It's an insoluble problem. The numbers tell you that. The numbers tell you this problem isn't within the realm of man to solve, much less wicked and evil men who are in power today. But that being said, men will follow after these vain thinkers until there is nothing left but stark reality, starvation, rioting, anarchy, revolution, and war. And when that comes, there will be death and destruction such as this world has never seen or experienced before. And to bring order out of this, these wicked and evil men will say, what we need to do is to line up and all of us get this number in our right hand and in our foreheads. And if we do that, then we can keep our cars and our houses, and then we can keep our jobs, and the economy will flourish. And when these wicked and evil men tell us that, we will know that judgment is at hand. Right at hand. Now, our founding fathers, these ancient writers, knew and understood the scriptures, and they said it's written for a moral people. People have to be able to govern themselves in order to live free. The scripture is referred to by the scripture as being the perfect law of liberty. Look that word liberty up. The perfect law of liberty in Strong's Concordance. The Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the nation in which you find yourself today, does not guarantee you liberty. It was the Ten Commandments that guaranteed you that liberty. Your duty was to obey God and keep His commandments. Now, William J. Federer, I think, put it very succinctly when he said, the direct and indirect influence of the Ten Commandments on American law goes back in time to the development of English common law, and before that, to the origins of Western civilization. The Ten Commandments were the embodiment of the philosophy of government that a nation with more internal laws can exist with less external laws. That if a population had a commonly accepted internal code of conduct, then that population could exist with less of an external legal code. And the more internal restraints a citizenry has, the less external restraints were needed, and thus they could be free. Translated, what he's saying here is that the man who is governed best is governed least. And the man who is governed least is the man who governs himself. And the Ten Commandments is the model for self-restraint and self-government. Our founding fathers in our Constitution and Republican form of government created a system of laws based upon the Ten Commandments to allow every man to live in liberty. But the supposition was that every man would be governing himself by the Ten Commandments. When a population degenerates into a form of lawlessness, and when we reject the Ten Commandments, then there need be then some other form of restraint. You see, you don't need a law that says drive 55 or 65 or 70. You yourself should be able to determine what speed you should be driving based upon your own common sense. And after all, the Ten Commandments are based upon common sense. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. That's a common sense law. Once you understand that, it's very simple to figure out, would I want that man to be sleeping with my wife? And if the answer is, no, I would not want that, well then, your common sense should tell you, then neither should I sleep with his wife. That's common sense. Young people today, riding around in cars, with guns in their hands, shoot people on street corners. Those people do not have the Ten Commandments as a moral guide. They don't understand, you shall do no murder. They don't understand a law that says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. As a result, then, we have to hire people, call policemen, to go out and maintain order. So we have to hire those policemen to carry billy clubs and guns, and they maraud around in cars, looking for other people marauding around in cars, shooting people off the streets. Now, the net result of this huge influx of police protecting us from criminals has, of and by itself, produced a humongous criminal enterprise of and by itself. Let me describe it. About 1964, a case came down called Miranda versus Arizona. It's the famous Miranda warning case. It's a long case, and it's an involved case. It's 109 pages. For Supreme Court writers, or for a Supreme Court opinion, to be more than 5 pages is exceptional. If it's 20 or 25 pages, it's onerous. Miranda is 109 pages. I mean, it is way beyond onerous. And yet, the writer evidently thought that 109 pages was necessary to convey the law, the meaning, the background, the understanding that the court was undertaking that day. So, in the treatise, they pointed out that in the United States, there are about 40,000 police agencies. Now, 40,000 police agencies back in 1964, I would submit to you today there are more agencies today than there were then, and they're bigger. And at that time, the Supreme Court estimated that each one of those agencies would commit one crime a day in the form of a civil rights violation. That is, that the police, who are hired to go out on the streets to protect us from the criminals, who we failed to teach the Ten Commandments to. Remember, our children, we didn't teach them the Ten Commandments. They grew up, and now they're out on the streets, shooting people off the street corners. And like Bernie Madoff, obviously was not taught the law that says thou shalt not steal. And as a result of that, he went out and he stole $50 or $60 billion from the investors. So, as a result of the Bernie Madoffs and the other criminals on Wall Street and in big business, we had to come up with a Securities and Exchange Commission, which is staffed by still more criminals. We call them government agents. And these government agents then take bribes. They take gifts from lobbyists. Our politicians make our laws, and they're taking gifts. Evidently, nobody ever told them that a gift perverts the eyes of the wise. And as a result of that, then we have bribe-giving and bribe-taking lawmakers who hire bureaucrats who are totally bereft of any morality. And they, in turn, then try to regulate and control the ordinary criminals in our society, like Bernie Madoff. It's as if we have the blind leading the blind. And so the Supreme Court, looking at this, said that they estimated that there was one civil rights crime, one civil rights violation committed against citizens of America every day of the year, at least once by one of these government agencies. And so I just took my Sharp EL-1197G3. Now watch this. Let's just take 40,000 police agencies. And then we'll hit the multiplier key. That's times 365 days in a year. And that totals 14,600,000 crimes. 14,600,000 crimes committed every day by the police against you and me. Now, one of these agencies, the FBI, keeps track of how many crimes are committed here in the United States by criminals. Just ordinary Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife burglars and criminals and others in our society who are also bereft of the Ten Commandments and a moral guide. They, the FBI tells us, that is, the criminals, commit 14 million crimes a year. So I'm going to write 14 million under the 14,600,000 perpetrated by our police, and that totals 28,600,000 crimes a year, which are committed against you and I by both the police and the criminals. And I want you to notice here that the police that we hired to protect us from the criminals commit 600,000 crimes more every year than the real criminals that we hired these guys to protect us from. And those are the crimes and the criminals that we have identified. Criminals like Bernie Madoff and the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Goldman Sachs institutions and General Motors and all of these multinational corporations who park their profits in offshore bank accounts so they don't have to pay the income taxes, and the multinational corporations who are outsourcing jobs of Americans to China and around the world in violation of various and sundry laws enacted by Congress, and the congressmen who are taking bribes in the form of campaign contributions that perverts their wisdom so that they make these dumbass laws that they enforce upon the rest of us and the rest of the dumbass population that follow those dumbass laws because we ourselves are bereft of any moral anchor or guideline because we don't practice the Ten Commandments. And then we're all of us wandering around in a great daze and a great fog wondering, why is it that we have so much lawlessness in America? And for that matter, around the world. All right, with that, I got to remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. And if you'd like more information about the law school and Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. All right, finally, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you're hearing on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the philosophy of law, the Ten Commandments, written in American law. Now, this is a book that I'm reviewing, about 300 pages in all. Dynamite book, I might add. And it's written by a fellow named William J. Federer, F-E-D-E-R-E-R, The Ten Commandments and Their Influence on American Law is the title. They've got a website. Most of you will want to go to the website and find out if you can get a copy of it, www.amerisearch.net, www.amerisearch.net. There's one other source here. Down in Austin, Texas, there's a bookstore called Brave New Bookstore. And they're at bravenewbookstore.com. When you can't find a book, you know, if you'll go to bravenewbookstore.com, they'll go find it for you. Bravenewbookstore.com. That's 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, Austin, Texas, 78705. That's their location, physically, if you're in and around Austin, Texas. You can also call them on the telephone. Number's 512-480-2503. That's 512-480-2503. BraveNewBookstore.com. I think this book is also available from Artisan Sales, A-R-T-I-S-A-N, Artisan Sales. I believe it's a book publishing company in Oklahoma. I'll give them a try if you can't find anywhere else. Barnes & Noble. All you really need here is a couple of items. The name of the book is called The Ten Commandments and Their Influence on American Law. And the author's name is William J. Federer. Federer. F-E-D-E-R-E-R. That ought to take you through Barnes & Noble and ought to get you a copy of it. Remember, in reviewing a book, all I can do is hit some of the high spots. I think the highest spot in the book was the revelation that the author had consulted more than 15,000 documents. 15,000 documents. Books, treatises, tracts, letters, and so on, from literally hundreds of our founding fathers. Like, Sir Francis Bacon wasn't a direct founding father of the United States, but he influenced our founding fathers. John Locke was not directly a signer of the Declaration of Independence, but the signers of the Declaration had all read John Locke's work. And Blackstone's commentaries. Sold more Blackstone's commentaries here in the United States than in England. And these early writers referenced and held up the Ten Commandments as the basis of law, the foundation of law. Today, we give God the finger, threw the Bible out in the streets, and we're following after Timothy Gaither, Henry Paulson, and helicopter Ben Bernanke. Now you go figure. My conclusion is I think that's going to come to a no good end in the final analysis. Now, there's one more factor that we ought to tuck in here. There are other writers from all over the world, Edmund Burke, Benjamin Franklin, Abigail Adams, Abraham Baldwin, George Washington, James Madison, Noah Webster, Jedediah Morris, John Quincy Adams, James McHenry, Samuel Adams, Alexis de Tocqueville, Daniel Webster, Francis Wayland, Lyman Beecher, Robert Winthrop, Wesley Marriott, Theodore Parker, William Bryant, Woodrow Wilson, J. Edgar Hoover. I could go on. I mean, I could probably cite another 50 right here in front of your eyeballs. I don't think that it's necessarily prudent to sit here and cite all these people, but they wrote 15,000 books amongst all of them, tracts and papers. Federer went to them and he took a look at them, and the least common denominator was that they all believed in, all advocated, and all promoted the Ten Commandments as the basis of law. Just that simple. No fuss, no muss. Turning to the last one over here, J. Edgar Hoover, I thought that was kind of an odd one. Well, with Hoover's reputation and all. J. Edgar Hoover had a little autobiographical sketch here. He says, J, that stood for John Edgar Hoover. He was born in 1895, died in 1972. He was the American director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, commonly called the FBI, and he held that position from 1924 to 1972. He graduated from George Washington University in 1916. He earned a master's degree in law in 1917, served as assistant to the Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer. He became famous for his dramatic campaigns to stop organized crime. And J. Edgar Hoover explained it this way. In writing the introduction to Edward L. R. Elson's book, America's Spiritual Recovery, 1954. When he wrote the introduction, Hoover said this, "We can see all too clearly the devastating effects of the resultant secularism on our Christian way of life. The period when it was smart to debunk our traditions undermined inspiring customs and high standards of conduct. A rising emphasis on materialism caused a decline of God-centered deeds and thoughts. The American home became a place of transient, furtive living and ceased to be a school of moral and spiritual education. When spiritual guidance is at a low ebb, moral principles are accordingly in a state of deterioration. Secularism advances in periods when men forget God. But there are hopeful signs for a better day. There was hope in the words of General Eisenhower when he bowed his head on inaugural day and asked in part, 'Give us, we pray, the power to discern right from wrong, and allow all of our words and actions to be governed thereby and by the laws of this land.' This humble prayer touched Americans from coast to coast, and here was hope manifested in a manner which inspired the hearts of countless millions. A president with such a deep religious sense and with such a sincere spiritual motivation, seeking to be guided by the right, sets an example for all of the people." That was J. Edgar Hoover, wrote that in a foreword in a book, talking about Dwight D. Eisenhower when he took office in 1953. Now, I might point out here that our principle of law was called separation of church and state, and our founding fathers intended to separate church and state, but not in the way that church and state has been separated by our secular leaders today. The intent was not to segregate or to separate out religion and religious thought, or the Ten Commandments and the laws of God from government. It was rather to separate the government out of the church and out of the church's business, which was to teach the Ten Commandments and the laws of God. In short, this separation of church and state was to separate government from the church. It was not to separate the church from government. And 15,000 documents is a hell of a lot more of an argument than the BS that we receive today from those wicked and evil men in places of power and authority, telling us that we should abandon the Ten Commandments and to abandon the laws of God in favor of bribe takers in our Congress and the bribe givers who come from big business and Wall Street. But there's more. Wisdom is bound up in the counsel of wise men. And so in Scripture, God instructs us to rise before the hoary head, and that there is safety in a multitude of counsel. Safety in a multitude of counsel. The book of Proverbs is probably the number one book in the Scripture. Number one. Well, at least for everyday garden variety living. I'm not taking away from the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments. I refer to the book of Proverbs quite often because Proverbs is written for Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. That's right. The book of Proverbs is a guide for everyday living. It is the book for Joe and Sally to determine how they ought to live their life. Should I sign this contract with the bank to buy this house? And the counsel of Proverbs says, no, no. Get the hell away from that as fast as possible. Because usury is a crime, and surety and suretyship will lead you to poverty. It adds discretion to the young man who's going on leave when the aircraft carrier ties up in Alameda, and all of his friends say, come on, Bob, let's go down to Flo's place. Two chapters in Proverbs, chapter 5 and chapter 7, gives discretion to the young man, 19 years old, who would go to Flo's whorehouse, and advises him that the strange woman leads strong men down into the pit. That's right, fellas. Those sweet little women in the whorehouse take strong men and lead them to death by way of AIDS, herpes, and VD, little microorganisms that you can't see, big fella. And in the final analysis, the revelation that comes from our Creator is bound up in these wise old sayings that are contained in 31 chapters called Proverbs. That's the book of life. If you want a book to tell you how to live your everyday life, how to handle your boss, and how to deal with the everyday problems of life, it's the book of Proverbs. These men were all familiar with the book of Proverbs. I can tell by listening to their writings that these are people who have read the Proverbs and understand those dark sayings. Now listen to a fellow named William Bryant. Bryant, born in 1794, died in 1878. He was an American poet and editor. He, known as the father of American poets, and wrote such titles, you know, To Waterfowl, Death of the Flowers, and The Fringed Gentian. He was the editor-in-chief of the New York Evening Post for 50 years. He was the editor of the Evening Post, 50 years editor, lending its support to the formation of the Republican Party and the fight against slavery. William Bryant wrote this. He said, the very men who, in the pride of their investigations into the secrets of the internal world, turn a look of scorn upon the Christian system of belief, are not aware how much of the peace and order of society, how much of the happiness of households, and the purest of those who are the dearest to them, are owing to the influence of that religion extending beyond their sphere. These men in office today have no concepts of right and wrong. They steal billions of dollars from people. They impoverish millions. They export jobs from America to China, and at the very same time exploit Chinese labor for their own profits. There is never enough money. A man with $60 billion still hasn't got enough. He's got to steal more. You'd think that by the time you'd stolen $5 billion, you should make an exit, don't you? Ordinary people like us, you know, the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives down here at the bottom of the pool, the bottom feeders, you know, if we could steal $100,000, we'd be pretty damn happy, wouldn't we? Surely if we could steal $1 million or $2 million, you know, we'd go into retirement. Not these fellas. These fellas run multinational corporations that are stealing millions and millions and billions and billions, and they never are satiated, never get enough. If Bernie Madoff were alive and out on the streets today having succeeded in stealing $60 billion, if this downturn in the economy hadn't revealed his crimes, he would have continued on until he stole $120 billion. He wouldn't have screwed 3,000 investors, he'd have screwed 6,000 investors, and then 12,000 investors out of $240 billion had he had the opportunity. The man is an obvious sociopath. The nation is led by these sociopaths. They occupy every office from the White House down to the dog catcher of Poughkeepsie, New York, interspersed occasionally with an honest man. That's the extent of the graft, the crime, the corruption, the illegal influences that have permeated America. Now somebody's going to write me a letter and say, "Oh my God, you're so negative and just down. You know, you're a Chicken Little." No, I'm a reporter. I'm just telling you that's where it's at. Wake up and smell the coffee. There comes a point in time when even God Almighty Himself runs out of patience. Hell, I ran out of patience years ago. When I got a belly full of it, I closed my company down. I said, to hell with this. I'm not going to do this anymore. I faced graft and corruption as early as 1980 when I was invited by the Small Business Administration, long before we ever heard the words outsourcing or offshoring. I got a letter from them. They said, "We'll loan you, Mr. Gordon, we want to loan you $500,000. We want to write you a check for $500,000. To give you an opportunity to move your business out of Boise, Idaho, and move it to Juarez, Mexico, to the free trade zone, and set up down there where you can take advantage of $2 an hour labor. And you can then export your products out of Mexico into the United States duty-free." I could have exported 30 jobs out of Boise, Idaho, and taken them to Juarez, Mexico. Now, I elected not to do that. I said to myself at the time, dumb as I was, I said, "What in the hell is that all about? Why would our government want to move 30 jobs out of Boise, Idaho, and move them to Mexico? How does that benefit those 30 men? How does that benefit me? How does that benefit our nation? How does that benefit the income tax or the support of our nation or the support of our military?" I couldn't see any redeeming value in such an offer coming from the Small Business Administration. You think I was the only guy in America to get that letter? Let me tell you, most of the guys said, "Hey, that sounds like a great idea to me." And then they moved their businesses to Mexico, and the bigger ones moved them to China. Look at Walmart, biggest importer in the nation. And they import from overseas everything that they can. How does that benefit you truck drivers or you auto workers in Detroit or Flint, Michigan? It doesn't. And, hey, listen, you can sit here and say, "Well, it's just the way things worked out." Maybe. But all of these men are bereft of the Ten Commandments. Keep in mind, the Ten Commandments is designed for a moral people. People that practice the Ten Commandments display morality. had a guy the other day wrote me a letter. In fact, he wrote a sign, put it out here at the end of my driveway, and he said, George Gordon violates eight of the Ten Commandments. He called me everything but a white man. He said, this guy is a liar, a thief, and a cheat. All right, now let's suppose for the sake of our discussion here that the man's telling you the truth. Hell, I wouldn't deny it. I've done all of the above. But now with that having been said, how does that detract from the Ten Commandments? If I don't practice the Ten Commandments, does that send a signal to you that you shouldn't? No, I tell you. America became the wealthiest, most powerful, prosperous nation on planet Earth. The world's number one predominant power. Described in the book of Revelation as the beast. And who can make war with the beast? Now, there are out there some who are trying to make war with the beast, but they're not faring out so well. The beast will be destroyed, but when it's destroyed, it'll be destroyed by God himself. Not by the mere desires of men making war with the beast. But the moral to the story is that this beast power over here has no longer the will or the capacity to follow those principles of law outlined in our Ten Commandments, in our Bill of Rights, in our founding documents. That's what's wrong with America. That's why we're going into national captivity. Because when we practiced the Ten Commandment model, we became the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world, militarily, economically, socially, politically. I mean, we were number one. Starting about 1950, we started down a slippery slope. We're way down the slope now. There's no getting back up to the top. You can forget that. Now, those of you out there who haven't gone down the slippery slope yet, don't follow the rest of us. Don't follow us. Where we're going is no goodsville. Our founding fathers placed a high priority on the Ten Commandments and morality. They believed that our Constitution, our founding documents, were designed for a moral people. People who could regulate and govern themselves. And the man who is governed least is governed best. If you want more liberty, then you have to have more self-restraint. The Ten Commandments is that guide. It is that moral restraint. Thou shalt not commit adultery. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not kill. Those are moral restraints. When we learn those moral restraints and put them into practice, we don't need policemen. We don't need the Securities and Exchange Commission. We don't need this army of bureaucrats and social ladies to run around telling us when to get up in the morning, when to go to bed at night, and what to do in between. Now, if on the other hand, we cannot govern ourselves, then the only other alternative is to be governed by a strong hand from someplace. Somebody out there then has to govern and control us. And now that we have all of that government and control in the form of 2.5 million laws, and they keep telling us we need more and more laws and more policemen to govern what? To govern our aberrant behavior and our criminal activities. Because we are now a nation totally bereft of the moral guides, the Ten Commandments, to govern ourselves. Well, I'm about out of time here again, boys and girls. I got to remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and all archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. Got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.